about that, I'll just tell you, one, the social responsibility amendment to the federal constitution that we're proposing that says that the SRA says every corporation with an income of more than $50 million, we're not talking about little mom and pop operations here, talking about $50 million or more, every corporation, every large corporation, must get a new corporate charter once every 10 years. And it will only get that new corporate charter if it can prove to a jury of ordinary citizens that it has a satisfactory history of social responsibility. So talking about love and caring and generosity has to be made concrete in every institution. And we have to ask, okay, we're going to judge every institution and social practice by how much love it generates, how much kindness, how much caring. That's not to say that we're against money, we're urging everybody to buy it, to burn their money. No, we understand that people also need material survival. But that can't be the whole of it. That can't be the whole of the vision. And it can't be the whole of the vision of a liberal and progressive movement that only talks about redistributing money. Yes, we absolutely need redistribution, and that's why I'm proud to be a liberal and proud to be a progressive. I'm proud to be part of the left. But we absolutely need financial redistribution. We need to take care of the poor. We need to change the system so that there aren't the poor. We need to eliminate it. And one part of our program for what we want to do in order to deal with Homeland Security is we need...
All this hocus-pocus rhetoric that you spout off, talking about the only way these corporations, which are private-based institutions, are going to be able to maintain their charters is if they prove satisfactorily that they have a history of social responsibility. A privatized machine proving that it has a history of social responsibility. You mean like IBM? That helped facilitate the Nazis in their little death camp brigade. This is about power, control, and thinking that you're going to have corporations espouse forms of love. It's basically throwing mystical dust in the air. But then again, you are a sorcerer, so what can one expect? Here comes the slave's perspective. Check it out. Into 103.3, 101.1 freakradio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, 104.1, 107.5 North Carolina, 96.3 Surge Radio in Antelope Valley, Upstart Radio, LUVER.com, The World Propaganda Press, and RadioForAll.net, The Universe, and check out the Slave Web. Videos, archives, blog, etc. Just Google in Slave Revolt Radio. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to go beyond the shadows with some left-hand parlor tricks of those within the empire. So we got all that and hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Attention, seekers everywhere. I was right. Everything I knew was wrong.
progressives, quote unquote, continued to twirl themselves in a nervous confusion. They continued to make excuses, create scapegoats, and pose contradictory solutions to the crisis humanity finds itself in. Michael Lerner is one such whirling dervish sorcerer. He's a part of this magazine called Tycoon. I don't know if he's the editor or what, but it's supposed to be like a progressive Hebrew magazine. He recently has written a book called The Left Hand of God, which exemplifies such parlor tricks that him and his likes like to get into. We're going to do a Beyond the Shadow segment on this particular issue called The Left Hand of the Empire, and deal with some of these questions. So first let's hear Lerner outline some of his positions on some of this type of stuff, and then let us take it from there. Dig this.
After the last election, I felt that it was extremely important to put out the information that I had been getting in the past 29 years studying the psychodynamics of American society. Because what I and my colleagues at the Institute for Labor and Mental Health had been studying was why middle-income working people who were previously Democrats were moving to the right politically. Now, I'm not talking about the hardcore of the right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about the people who are the most extreme fundamentalists. I'm talking about tens of millions of Americans who used to be Democratic Party voters and who moved to the right. And we were trying to figure out why in the world would they do such a thing when it's so much against their economic interests.
Right.
And what we discovered was that there, for them, the central issue was not their economic well-being, not that it didn't matter to them,
right,
but that there was another level of need in their life, a need for a framework of meaning and purpose in their life, something to connect them to the higher purpose. And in the work world, all day long they were learning the bottom line of money and power, looking out for number one. They came home into a life in which everybody else was looking out for number one. And so they're surrounded by selfishness and materialism. They're surrounded, they spend every day in a work world in which they can't see how what they're doing contributes to a higher good. And of course, when we heard this from ordinary middle-income working-class people, we said, we can't believe this, because we had been taught as part of the left, as part of the liberal or academic and intellectual world, that only we had higher needs, that the rest of the people only had material needs. So when we listened to that, we suddenly understood that what was going on, because what they were saying to us was, the right is speaking to these spiritual needs that we have, to a hunger for meaning, for a life that isn't based on materialism and selfishness. The left only talks about economic entitlements and political rights. It tells us that it will get us equal opportunities. Well, of course, we want equal opportunities, but of course, once you get those equal opportunities, that doesn't necessarily provide you with a satisfying life. So many of these people were attracted to the right first through the religious right, because the religious right was talking about meaning and purpose and higher vision and love and caring and kindness, and they were not hearing that kind of discourse from the left.
Okay, this is what I mean by shameless parlor tricks played out by Lerner. One of the things he does is he throws everything into this like giant cabal. Like all these people who quote unquote went white people basically, who went from the Democrats to the Republicans, all did it out of this kind of absence of a spiritual being. Just like one large lump, all feeling spiritually neglected. Now, one, thing is that one of the parlor tricks you have to do is leave out large patches and threads and string theories of history. Like, for instance, you know, during much of this period, you know, especially like during the civil rights in the 60s and 70s, there was what was called the Great White Flight. Now, these white people who were fleeing many of the cities into the suburbs and isolating themselves as much as possible from the urban black and brown masses, they weren't doing this because of any kind of lack of spirituality that they were seeing in the urban areas. They were doing it based off of their white skin prejudices and privileges that are constructed within this society. And these types of prejudices are things that are not only, of course, exploited within this society, but promoted and, on a certain material level, are given beneficiary advantages to those who play into that game. The suburbs were then financed in large parts by the urban masses, the building of the suburbs. The taxes were going, much of the taxes would go out into the building of the suburbs. So in other words, urban people were subsidizing the advancement of many of these suburbs where white flight was going. And since whiteness is also an economic construct, just being white, neighborhoods that become predominantly white or whiter, the economic value of that land, that property, since whiteness is also property, goes up. So this type of aspect played a role in creating a larger schism, because many whites were not willing to integrate, to facilitate other perceptions of the country, to share some of the crumbs that other people who are being brutalized within this society, in this economic order, were trying to ascertain to. They took the stepping. And this, of course, was helped facilitate it and played right into the hands of what the Republicans were orchestrating at the time and even before, which was called the Southern Strategy, which Nixon played in like a fine-tuned pianist, like a classical composer. And the Southern Strategy was basically a strategy outlined by the Republicans to make the white Democratic voters feel alienated from the urban black masses, the youth at the time, which were like, you know, anti-war hippies, so on and so forth, and the poor. So the young, the poor, and the black was the strategy outlined by these Southern strategists. And it worked successfully. And a hallmark and calling card of the Southern strategy was not to try to reach so much other white folks through any kind of spiritual base, but it was to demonize large segments of this undesirable, quote-unquote, population, the young, the poor, and the black. So Lerner just hears what he wants to hear, because he's a sorcerer himself. So he wants to pretend like here all these people are feeling some spiritual necessity, and all this is basically white folks talking to white folks, making excuses and lying to one another, and believing in each one, believing in, at least on a certain level, the myths that they're telling. So Lerner's run into these white folks that are now Republicans. They're making excuses why they went Republican. Lerner believes what he wants to believe, what they're defecating out. He then spins it and defecates right back. And all you have is just white myth making the same type of myth-making that has gone on for years about why the Klan and other groups needed to come into formation to crush Reconstruction because blacks were just acting crazy all over the place. This type of myth that is deeply embedded within the American tradition, where you have segments of the white population talking to themselves and not confronting the real racial, economic, social realities at hand, just making up stuff and then believing in the myth. Now, you also have a situation where he says that they were attracted to the right because the right was speaking about love and higher purposes. The right, these right-wing Christians have always pushed out a domination type of theology. The dominant figure, hell and brimstone, so on and so forth. That's been a hallmark of the Christian element of white domination since the birth of this country. It has always played a tyrannical reign on its various subjects and slaves. It has always justified the crushing, demonization, and brutalization of the slaves, and it is always given a false sense of superiority and a false sense of destiny to white folks for what they have constructed as their perceived right. Whether we're talking manifest destiny and the onward march of many of these whites throughout this Christian tradition, throughout Indian territory, or through the whole justification of slavery that the Christian church in the South played a pivotal role. So here's someone who's intentionally being ahistorical. Now, I don't know if he's just so much of a fool that he doesn't even know these types of elements of the history, but one thing is clear. These cats are just talking to themselves in basically support of a kind of belief system that basically safeguards their particular privileges in whiteness, in patriarchy, in economic order, so on and so forth. Now, he also plays the classic little game that kind of also exposes him for what he is when he says that, people of working class interests are going to the, why are they going to the right and to the Democratic Party, he means by that, I mean to the Republican Party, since it's against their economic interests. In other words, he's saying that going from Democrat to the Republican is against their economic interests, thereby underlining the fact that basically he's a Democrat. So instead of just saying I'm a raggedy Democrat, that's where I stand, you know, and then try to defend that position from there, instead being the parlor trick sorcerer that he is, he wants to blend it in with this sorcery spiritual connection. In reality, when all the smoke and mirrors and pomp and pageant is over with, he's a Democrat. He's just throwing Wizard of Oz mystical dust to try to justify and put a new twist on the defense of the Democratic Party. Because at the end of the day, if you support the Democratic Party, you support violence. You are violent. The Democratic Party is one of the most violent institutions on the planet, just like their Republican sidekicks. And if you support the Democratic Party, vote propagandize for them, you cannot consider yourself nonviolent. period. Now here Lerner talks about how his study has been taking place since the 1980s. So let's check this out.
Study started then, but we've continued it right through this last election, and we had people in our that we interviewed in this last election saying the exact same thing. It's not the way that it's been misconstrued by the media is that these values or spiritual aspirations are really just code words for anti-abortion or anti-homosexual activity. Well, it's true that the core of the right uses the spiritual hunger and then manipulates it and says, if you want to be part of our spiritual community, one of the costs of that is demean the others, demean those people who are not part of the community. But inside the community, we will give you a huge amount of support, of caring, of love. We will affirm some higher values for you. And so people, very often people buy into it, not because they're essentially homophobic or, you know, I mean, some of the people we interviewed, probably a third of them, were people of color. It's not just white people who are attracted to the right. And so we're talking to them and saying, how can you be part of this? And they're saying, because I was part of of my union or my Democratic Party group, and I always felt put down for having any spiritual desires or put down for being religious, or I felt like they just, as a whole, didn't understand, they didn't have a clue that there was anything else in life but money. And as good as the Democrats are and the left are, they tell us, about those money issues, and we're all for them, we agree with them on those issues, still, there's something else that's lacking in our life. And when I have to deal with my kids, single mothers, single black mothers, which tells us, I have to deal with my kids, and they don't seem to have any values, I can't get those values being discussed in the left. All the left values that they're talking about is equal opportunity or equal rights. But that's not what's affecting my kid. My kid wants things, right. And they're not talking about that.
Okay, this is real cynical. Real cynical. Here this clown goes on about, first he says that people being attracted to the religious right is more or less misconstrued by the media. It's not just anti-abortionism and things of that particular nature. But one of the things that we have seen concerning the anti-abortion movement and element is that all of the terrorism and violence that they have heaped upon women's clinics, abortion performing doctors, women at clinics, etc., etc., manuals on how to cut off the thumbs of abortion performing doctors and all this other traditional American values madness, by and large, the religious right has not ostracized those elements. And people who have gone into these particular types of movements, or the Republican Party in general, have not ostracized that element. This is more or less about control. These are hierarchical institutions and belief systems, religions are. And often, as I said before, these Abrahamic religions, Islam, Christians, Hebrons, these religions are a patriarchal order, and putting women in their place is part of their patriotic duty for many elements of that. And so this all goes par for the course. So unless you address these types of issues in institutions, you're just basically blowing smoke, especially when at the same time he's saying that these people came over to these particular institutions because this is where they found support, care, and love. Well, what form of support, love, and care are you really talking about? What is it based in? What does it quote-unquote represent for you? In other words, you can have a situation where people say that they get a lot of support, care, and love and all of that. And that's why they joined the Ku Klux Klan, which is why many people did join the Ku Klux Klan. But part of that support was supporting a racial orthodox hierarchical order and domination over the black masses. And they got care and love out of working out of those particular institutions within that vehicle, within their terroristic dynamic. So to explore the fact that one person's form of support and care can be radically different from another person's concept, but just to just throw terms around without going into the history, the dynamics, what these things represent, is basically a charlatan game. Now, he also talks about how he a third of the people they talked to were people of color. Now, we don't know what people of color or the overall numbers that he's talking about. I mean, he could have talked in large part to a number of, you know, just right-wing Cubans or something. It's, you know, we don't know the overall number. So, so of what this third is. So, some of these aspects can't really be addressed without seeing some of the effects on the ground. But what is clear is that when he says that people were saying that the left doesn't seem to talk about anything, but doesn't talk about values and all of that, and this gets into the whole materialism thing. Now, we've seen all of these things take place under Republican and Democratic institutions, SNL banditry, Enron banditry, and those two, particularly the SNL whole crisis, thievery, etc., was deeply rooted within the Republican administration. This doesn't mean that the Republicans are any worse than the Democrats, but this was during the period when many of these people were going from Democrat to quote-unquote Republican. So how can one talk about values when this type of banditry, when the Contra stuff was going on, when the whole Iran crisis and period was going on? The U.S. was found guilty under a Republican administration of international terrorism against the Nicaraguans. Well, see, this gets to the aspect of the great American illusion, the denial, the different perceptions of what the truth or what justice is. For many people, American justice, for many people, especially white people, American justice is the death penalty. Now, no matter how many facts you may throw out about how many people are wrongly convicted, how the racial class dynamic plays in to who gets the death penalty, less than 1% of the population actually is charged with death penalty, and is more predicated on the color of the person that is killed than anything else, etc., etc. Well, many of these people, who, in the face of these facts, in the face that over 120 people have been released from prison just by Barry Sheck and Peter Neufeld alone, not all were on death row, through the Innocence Project, and but over 100 people since the 70s have been released just on who have been convicted of murder since that time, showing the fallacy and often the brutality, the criminal brutality, think John Burrs, the torturer out of Chicago, of the system. This doesn't, for many of these people, this does not hinder them or often even give them a second thought, because many of them are coming from a domination theology. Now, much also of this whole religious right, as he calls it, it basically bases a lot of its whole construct, since it has elements of, in a more modern context of the Southern strategy, around what? Patriotism, support of the military, which is on a superficial level, because once they get back, they don't really care about them. And even when they are not being properly protected with vests and things of that particular nature, the average person who screams about, or let me put it this way, you don't see the religious right coming and smashing on Boy George for sending all these troops out there without being properly protected, you know, their vehicles, their own personal body armor, and so on and so forth. Now, personally, I'm glad about that, because I want the U.S. military machine crushed. But for all the support of the military is what I'm saying. For many of these people within this type of movement in society is on a superficial level. And that goes through all of the things that they say they stand for. The family values rhetoric, the patriotism, and all of that. This is about domination and the justification of it by any and all means. Especially when you talk, when many of these people include these concepts of values and American way of life. And here in the face of all of this madness, the institutions that they support have been caught red-handed in torture, using weapons of mass destruction, false imprisonment, rendering, etc., etc. This is a criminal, barbaric society. That's all that is to it. And many of the people who support various elements within these institutions, i.e. have relationships, because that's all this is. Whether you're talking about governments, organizations, collectives, they're just relationships. Relationships people have freely or through coercion or through force, but they're still relationships. So these relationships that people have are often based in something. They feel that they can get something out of it. Now, it may not be all of what they can get out of it, but they feel that they can get some type of material gain or whatever out of it. And often these are the basis of where they're coming from, and they'll throw the smoke, just like Lerner does, to kind of justify and make lofty their particular goals, aims, and objectives. Now here, Lerner explains his version of the religious right's contradiction. So check this out.
Religious, yeah, I mean, I think that the religious right is filled with contradictions, and that, you see, the reason why they're able to get away with this is because the right, the left has given the whole sphere of spirituality and religion over to the right. The left has two visions about spirituality. It's either flaky thinking, that is new, kind of a silly New Age vision. Okay, not
I'm sure
at all New Age.
People who are into, you know, different New Age religions,
no,
I don't think it's silly. But
No, I don't either. I think there are many parts of the New Age that are very smart and insightful. Mm-hmm. But what I was saying is they portray it as silly New Age. Or they portray it as, the people on the left think of it as just a code word for the racism, the sexism, the homophobia, the militarism, and that there's no real spiritual crisis. So you see, what we have is the right taking a real spiritual crisis in people's lives and then manipulating it in a destructive and hurtful direction, and the left not being able to respond because they don't even know that there is a real spiritual crisis.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were to get it, and that's what this book, The Left Hand of God, tries to do, is to help people deeply understand what that crisis is, how it operates. You see, the left right now is, some people are saying, well, let's reframe the Democratic Party, throw in some Bible quotes, you know, and make it... Well, but the crisis in people's lives isn't that Democrats aren't
quoting Bible.
The crisis in their lives has to do with the materialism and selfishness, the lack of higher meaning in work, the inability to contribute to the common good, the sense of being surrounded by people who are only looking out for number one, the selfishness that makes it so hard to know who you can count on in life, even in your own loving relationships, because everybody has learned to be a maximizer of self-interest. So you never know if you're, even if your own partner won't at some point learn how to cut a better deal and then figure out a way to get out of your relationship because somebody else they've met can take care of more of their needs. So they're surrounded by uncertainty and insecurity. That's the spiritual crisis, and the left doesn't address it. So that gives the right, and see,
But what the right does with it is disgusting and full of contradictions. Right. But we can only challenge that if we are in that sphere. That's why we're creating a network of spiritual progressives. That is an actual national organization, which people can find on our website, www.spiritualprogressives.org. We are building an organization. We had a conference here in this summer in Berkeley, in which we had over 1,400 people, 1,380 exactly. And we had to turn away hundreds of other people from all branches of Muslims, Jews, mostly Protestants, 150 Catholics, Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, and many spiritual but not religious people, because see, our organization is not just for people who believe in God. It's also for people who are not part of a religion, but who have a spiritual sense and recognize that the spiritual aspirations of people is something just as serious as their material aspirations. So spiritual but not religious people have also been a central part of building this new network of spiritual progressives.
Alright, once again, he goes into all of this mixing and dabbling and stuff. It's to be expected. But let me address some of these issues that he was mystifying up when he goes into how, like, the left often refers to, you know, the spirituality thing as flaky or silly and so on and so forth. Or says that it's a code word for racism or homophobia. First of all, you have a situation where, as I've said before, these particular religions are a hierarchical institution. All one has to do is honestly read and look into these various press kit books that are, you know, propagandist books for these various faiths and stuff like that. Or observe, and one will see that at the end of the day, all of these particular the churches, mosques, temples, whatever, they're all built by humans. It wasn't some ray of light that came shooting out of the sky and built them. So they're all built by humans. All of the people who are supposed to have strong connections to these various super beings are all humans on the ground, whether they're popes, preachers, imams, whatever. And they have and are given special privileges in a hierarchical structure of and how they fit within their particular traditions. So they have certain advantages, they're giving certain privileges, and they have access to more economic and, in reality, material resources because of their positions. While the masses of people within any of these religions are not doing that well, the masses of Christians throughout the world economically are part of the servant and slave class, and they're getting their ass kicked. The masses of Islam throughout the world are part of the servant and slave class, and they're getting their ass kicked. So to not put in and break down the hierarchical structure of how these work, and how, as I've said before, they play into a form of secularism and a form of elitism. Because if you are running around believing that there is no God but Allah, or that Jesus Christ is your Lord and Savior, even though you never heard of this Jesus or Allah or whatever, but he created the universe and he's the true God, what you're saying is you have a monopoly on God. And you are also saying that you have that this God, and since you are part of that belief system, have a monopoly on truth, because the word of the God is supposed to be the word of the truth. This plays into, just by its own design, a very divisive and easily manipulated construct. that you can see is played out, whether it's manifest destiny amongst in the Americas, amongst the white population against blacks and especially the Indians in that crusade, or the Zionists of Israel justifying their expansion and domination of the Palestinian people, or the Zionists of Islam and how it's played out throughout North Africa historically, or in the Sudan and Mauritania currently, etc., etc. You know, what's also interesting is that when he talks about the spiritual crisis, as I've said, these guys have always used these mystics in dominant power, always use mysticism as a way of maintaining their power and authority, and of justifying what they're doing amongst themselves. It's part of their particular tradition, mindset, mentality, and very expansionist types of goals. Now, to make it kind of clear what I mean on this particular aspect, you know, I read some of that stuff from Fred Douglas, his autobiography a while back, but I'm going to go into a little part real quick about his experience with Mr. Kobe. Now, let's put that in the context of what Lerner was saying about spirituality and, you know, and all of that. In other words, I'm trying to make it clear that this is no new thing, that people in dominant positions of power, and I'm not even talking about just the elite, but those who are, you know, basically part of a servant type of element, how they play into the religion and buy into the hierarchical order, especially when they buy into the construct of whiteness itself. Now, going into Fred Douglas's book, it states here, quote, Mr. Kobe Forte, or Mr. Kobe, remember, was the Negro brick. Fred Douglas was sent to him when he was like 15 years old. Kobe, who was basically a working person, fairly poor, job was to break the slaves. They would, the slave masters would send their slaves to him for a year. They would work on Kobe's property. During that time, Kobe would brutalize them psychologically and physically to break their spirit so that they would be obedient slaves when they were sent back to their slave master. Kind of like what the police and various elements do today in our cities. Now, going on with the article, with the book. Quote, Mr. Kobe Forte consisted in his power to deceive. His life was devoted to planning and perpetrating the grossest deception. Everything he possessed in the shape of learning or religion, he made conform to his disposition to deceive. He seemed to think of himself equal to deceiving the Almighty. He would make a short prayer in the morning and a long prayer at night. And strange as it may seem, when few men would at times appear more devotional than he. The exercises of his family's devotions were always commenced with singing, and as he was a very poor singer himself, the duty of raising the hymn generally came upon me. He would read his hymn and nod at me to commence. I would at times do so, at other times I would not. My non-compliance would almost always produce much confusion. To show himself independent of me, he would start and stagger through with his hymn in the most discordant manner. In this state of mind, he prayed with more than ordinary spirit. Poor man, such was his disposition and success at deceiving. I do verily believe that he sometimes deceived himself into the Solomon belief that he was a sincere worshiper of the Most High God, and to this, too, at a time when he may be said to have been guilty of compelling his woman slave to commit the sin of adultery. The facts in this case are these. Mr. Kobe was a poor man. He was just commencing in life. He was only able to buy one slave, and shocking as it is the fact, he bought her, as he said, for a breeder. This woman was named Caroline. Mr. Kobe bought her from Mr. Thomas Lowe, about 6 miles from St. Michael's. She was a large, able-bodied woman, about 20 years old. She had already given birth to one child, which proved her to be just what he wanted. After buying her, he hired a married man of Mr. Samuel Harrison to live with him one year, and him to use to fasten up with her every night. The result was that at the time of the year, the miserable woman gave birth to twins. As this result, Mr. Pervay seemed to be highly pleased, both with the man and the wretched woman. Such was his joy, and that of his wife, that nothing they could do for Caroline during her confinement was too good or too hard to be done. The children regarded as being quite an addition to his wealth. Unquote. Now, the reason why I mention this is that here is this spiritual, religious man. But his whole thing is based in wealth. Even though he's a poor man, he's trying to ascertain more wealth. And even if that means using other human beings as breeders, keeping them as slaves, breeding them so that they'll produce more kids to produce more wealth, this did not come into contradiction at all with his faith. So when you hear this learner babble on about this, you know, what white folks are needing and what they say they are missing, which is why they are trying to move to from the Democrats to the Republicans, because they're finding some kind of spiritual connection there. It's just a bunch of junk. Whiteness is an economic construct. Whiteness is a patriarchal construct. Whiteness is a privatized elitist construct. So without addressing these aspects, he's just spinning intentionally in the dark, especially when at the end of the day, through all the smoke and mirror, Lerner's a supporter of the Democratic Party. An institution of violence, of decadence, of barbarity, of brutality. Now here, let's check out how Lerner responds to Andrea. This was the woman who was interviewing him on what these spiritual progressives, you know, more or less need to do or whatever. Check this out.
There are three main goals. Number one, to challenge the religious right and its manipulation of religion, because we think that they've taken only the right hand of God vision, namely God as a powerful being who runs the show, and they've manipulated that, because that vision in the Bible was a vision to empower the powerless, to say, there's on your side. If you can't figure out how to overthrow Pharaoh, there is a force in the universe that can be on your side, that you are, in whose image you are created, that can make it possible for you to overcome barriers that you thought were impossible to overcome, and to overcome forms of oppression. Now, what the religious right has done is it's taken that sense of God as this powerful force, and it has associated it with the elites of power and wealth in this country, so that instead of it being used to empower the powerless, it's used to empower the powerful to cut the programs for the poor and to lower their own income taxes and to justify militarism. Another total inversion of what the Bible's power over vision of God was for. It was to empower the powerless. But meanwhile, they simultaneously totally neglected the left side of God, that is the vision of God as a loving, caring, generous, kind being in whose image we are supposed to act as a loving, kind, and generous being. So, by the way, this isn't just in religion. Since we all have both voices in our heads, you will see right-hand domination view or left-hand caring view in the Marxism. You'll see it in psychoanalysis. You'll see it in feminism. You'll see it in every movement. Some people who talk about the world from the standpoint of we got to beat the other and dominate the other, and some people who talk about that the best way to build safety and security and the kind of world we want is through love and kindness and generosity. And that's, so anyway, the first point is to critique the right. The second point is to critique the religiophobia that exists in the left, and to make it impossible in the left to continue the kind of demeaning that makes people feel pushed away by the left. See, the left essentially, and here I'm talking about the Democratic Party, the Greens, the anti-war movement, most of the social change movements have, and the liberal culture way outside of those movements, that gives people the feeling that if you're into religion, or
you keep it quiet, right?
You've got to keep it quiet, or else that if you're really into it, you're probably on a lower level of psychological or spiritual or intellectual development. That you maybe you have an unresolved father issue. You're desiring authority. You need authority figures. You can't think for yourself. You want somebody to take over your mind. So this is the same kind of reductionism that led some people on the right used to say that if you're into socialism, you're for that because you want authoritarian figures like Stalin or, you know, Soviet Union type governments it misses the point that, yes, there are some people who want to escape from their freedom or want authority figures, but there are a lot of other people in the spiritual or religious world who are seeking a deeper understanding of reality and have had spiritual experiences that simply cannot be fit into the framework of a narrow materialist worldview.
Right. And the third?
The third is we are seeking a new bottom line in American society so that institutions, social practices, and legislation get judged efficient, rational, and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money and power, but also to the extent that they maximize love, caring, kindness, generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacities to respond to the others as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacities to respond to the universe, to nature, with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of creation. You talk that way in a liberal and progressive world. If you create a spiritual voice of that sort, you will transcend the old understanding of what left and right is. You will, in fact, win over a lot of people from all over the political spectrum who have never heard the left talking in an explicit and unembarrassed way about love, about kindness, about generosity, except for Martin Luther King, except for the black church, because the black church is the one place where people have been willing to talk this language, and that's why the left was never stronger than when it had King and that kind of leadership that was rooted in the church and yet out in the streets.
Okay, we see once again this charlatan game that's going on. One of the tactics that he's used, and I've talked about this before when I dealt with some of this hocus pocus stuff, where he was talking about how he wants to make it impossible for the left to, you know, being so religious phobia, you know, that to have this kind of anti-religious strain, when often basically a lot of it is just a critiquing. Now, what I find fascinating about this is that as you heard him say, he's been critiquing the left. He critiques whatever he wants, which I believe is right. He has a right to, and he has a right to do it through his spiritual outlook or whatever else. But as soon as anyone else looks at it from another or critiques the hocus pocuses or mocks the hocus pocuses, then they want to make it impossible. Then all of a sudden they get up in arms. This is like the whole Cartoon Network of religious censorship, the show we did a couple of weeks ago, where the hocus pocus types feel that they have a right to critique whatever they want, which they do. But if you mock or critique them, then it's hell and brimstones, because what you're critiquing for them is supposed to be sacred, which means untouchable. Get the hell out of here. Who do you savages think you are? This is ridiculous. But this is the mentality. But it's just a form of manipulation, censorship, and conditioning that these guys are trying to impose. Another thing is that these religions have always been used by the powerful. Always. You can talk about the masses and all of this type of stuff, the poor and so on. But from all the crusades, the jihads, all of that type of stuff, they were orchestrated by the more well-off, the powerful, the elite, and it benefits primarily them. So to leave that element out is basically to be playing a game that is beyond cynical. Now, also, when he talks about this whole new bottom line, you know, the new bottom line is for corporations to maximize their love and caring and all of that, it's a charlatan twist, because at the end of the day, he's still a Democrat. He supports the Democratic Party. So all of this nonsense about the bottom line of corporations maximizing love and all of that, this is no different than any rhetoric that you would expect to see or hear defecated out of the behind of crime Bill Clinton. You know, who would just throw smoke up, but you know his intentions because you also know his allegiance. Now, he mentioned how you heard the concept of love and all of this type of stuff out of the black church. Now, I don't have time to go too deep into this whole thing, but, you know, when you're talking about the black church and the black experience and all of that, you're talking about a freedom thrust. So, of course, you're talking about people who are trying to find and salvage their own humanity and see the commonality and goodness of humanity where they have been stripped of so much. So, of course, this is just a completely different tradition. And it doesn't matter what religion or whatever, you know, you're always going to have that thrust, whether you're talking about Haiti, where the primary practice is voodoo and stuff. Now, you know, if Lerner believes so much of this rhetoric about, you know, the religious right and why these people, you know, turn to the quote-unquote right, i.e. Republican end of the spectrum to find spiritual harmony and all of that, or to feel they're being talked to, etc., etc., Lerner needs to take his behind down to New Orleans right now, where all these right-wing white folks with their little religious cabals and all of that, that have orchestrated the domination and the expelling of black people, who are using various means to maintain this domination over the population, who are orchestrating a genocidal spatial deconcentration slash ethnic cleansing move on that population. See if all this rhetoric would work down there. Because at the end of the day, this is all about power relationships. This is about control, domination, and how whiteness and the construct of whiteness plays into that. So this is just more smoke. This is this hocus pocus dope peddling. He's just a dope peddler, a hocus pocus dope peddler. You know, and he is trying to create more dope fiends, dope addicts on the planet to buy into this whole nonsense. And that just brings up another aspect. What has barred, when Jackson has run for a president in the past, Sharpton has run for president, and both Jackson and Sharpton have historically used religion and the whole concept of love and, you know, sharing and responsibility and, you know, and all of that type of stuff. Now, of course, it's in complete contradiction because they both done it as Democrats. But my whole point is why haven't all of these white folks that have gone to the Republican Party, why didn't they come running back? Or is there something else to it that Lerner and others like him don't want to address? Now, also another aspect of what some of these guys don't want to address, when they always talk about the civil rights movement and things like that, let's go into Jim Lowen. He's the author of the book Lies My Teachers Told Me. And let's hear him talk about King's experience, not in the South, but in the Chicago suburbs. Let's see how that experience played out in 1966. Check this out.
Yeah. Other part of my work that I want to get into the conversation is my new work about sundown towns, and it ties in with King even more directly, because Martin Luther King's greatest defeat came about in the Chicago suburbs, and some of you are old enough to remember this. He had his great victories, there's no doubt about it, but his greatest defeat came in 1966 when he attempted to lead a march for open housing through the west side of Chicago, which is an all-white area, and then into Cicero, Illinois. And Cicero is a suburb of Chicago, and it was a sundown town. For listeners who don't know, a sundown town is a town that some of them even had signs typically saying, quote, "Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you," in Beacon, Illinois, for instance, which had such a sign, or Hawthorne, California, which had such a sign. These were towns, in other words, where blacks could not live, could not even rent property. And when they approached Cicero, they were struck with a barrage of thrown rocks and pieces of concrete and all kinds of things, and basically were not allowed to get into Cicero. 7 people were injured. 39 people were arrested, including a whole bunch of the marchers as well as some of the people throwing things. Why? Because some of the marchers threw the things back. And King actually said afterwards that he found the hatred there to be worse than in the South. and he never really succeeded there. He came back to Chicago. He did finally speak once at Winnetka, Illinois, which is another suburb. But Kenilworth, Illinois, the richest suburb, refused to let him speak, and Kenilworth may be a sundown town to this day. So I think that, to me, the way to remember King is to work on those causes where he expended much of his life. And I think the biggest single problem remaining in race relations in this country is residential segregation, including sundown towns that still exist.
Now, this gets into another aspect that many of these cats never really want to get into, and is that many of the civil rights aspects that, you know, King and them tried to ascertain, especially in the North, were completely crushed. So one cannot even call the civil rights movement a quote-unquote victory and stuff unless you're just being a very superficial person from a very ahistorical, superficial position. It was in 65 where Watts exploded. Here in the North, it was not the same type of segregation per se as far as water fountains and all of that type of stuff. If you've lived, or at least your, you know, grandparents and parents, well, grandparents and great grandparents knew here in the North that it was a much different experience for them here in the North than what they knew was going on or had experienced back in the South. And King and them were not able to penetrate and crack the nutshell of the way the game of the economic apartheid game was structured into the North. See, the various forms of Jim Crowism and all of that that were struck down in the various areas in the in the South, those types of things could more or less be done away with, because apartheid, like in South Africa, and Jim Crow is basically like a scaffolding. You use scaffolding to build the house of inequality for super white domination and exploitation. Once the house of inequality has been built, where whites have a super abundance of control of land, property, corporations within the private market system, etc., etc., influence, then you can take the scaffolding down, i.e. Jim Crow structures, the various forms of apartheid structures, because the house of inequality, which the capitalist system is built on, will stand by itself, which is exactly what has happened in North America and in South Africa, which is why you still have the masses of people in both countries being pulverized thoroughly within the society, even though the various forms of Jim Crowism and apartheidism has been taken away. So what the mystics want to do is always have you focus in on the various things that now the slaves and servants can now do, or somewhat do, like vote and all of that, without questioning the whole economic privatized construct and how it's designed and how it is a vehicle for super domination and exploitation. So this is how the riot explodes in 1965, even though it's in the North. You know, it's not in the South. that had to do with the fact that even though the Jim Crowism in the North did not exist like it did in the South, the same form of super exploitative social economic control maintained by white dominance was playing and has played and continues to play itself out. Now, as far as these sundown towns and how that plays itself out, you know, many of these guys always talk about integration, if we just integrate and all of that. And they want to focus in at if these people would integrate, they would lose some of their prejudices and all of that. But see, it's not just prejudice. Within the economic social order of the construct of whiteness, whiteness itself is an economic advantage. So to create sundown towns or to create communities that are dominant white, even for working class people, has an economic and material benefit, because the land and the value of the property is artificially maintained higher by the presence of more and more whites. So it's not just, is this person prejudicial or not? It's the whole economic construct and how it plays into the economic order. But see, learning them, they're just mystics. So they don't want to address this, or I don't even know if they thought of it. Whatever the case is, it's this junk. Now, here, Lerner, who is also the author of the book of The Politics of Meaning, which the crime Bill Clinton family loved, talks about Democrats getting more backbone, and if they do, with his Lernerism spiritual philosophy, how that can be done, more or less. So, let's check this out.
I don't think your thinking will itself give them the spine. Right. We have to have the spine. In other words, there are a huge number of people here who really would want a world of love and caring and generosity, only they've convinced themselves that this is so unrealistic and that they have to talk in terms of the realism of politics as it's defined today. If we could have the spine to speak about our own highest values, we could give our politicians the spine. Mm. The problem is that, and Hillary told me this at one point, you know, she gave me the story of FDR, who had met with the labor unions where they were trying to convince him to back the Lehman Bill in 1934 that would have allowed labor unions to organize. And after 4 hours of meeting with them, he said, "You have convinced me that you are entirely right." This is President Roosevelt. "You have convinced me you're entirely right. Now go out there and force me to do it." And what Hillary said to me was, you know, "I want to stand for these ideals because I totally agree with you, but I don't see a movement out there that is willing to give me the backing." Now, I said to her, "But you're the president. You know, I mean, you could help generate that movement." And she didn't have the sense of herself as a leader to be able to go there, to stand out for what she really believed in at the time. I'm not saying she would now, but we need a movement from below, and that's why we're creating this network of spiritual progressives, so that we can build the foundation. And we're having we put forward in the book the lesson.
We got to wrap up. So tell us about your conference and how people can get more information on all of this.
Yes, we're bringing to Washington May 17th to 20th, Washington D.C. The network and our covenant, spiritual covenant with America. We're meeting with Congress in that period. The Black Caucus has organized it. Get it at www.spiritualprogressives.org. You can find out all the information. Please join our organization. Come with us to Congress, or at least set up a study group around the book, The Left Hand of God, Taking Back Our Country from the Religious Right.
Okay, here we go again. Talks about how Hillary said, "I want to stand up for these ideas, but I don't see a movement." It's kind of incredible to hear this charlatan actually have the nerve to say this out in public, when we know that the Democratic Party, along with their Republican allies, have been in the forefront as far as institutions in service to the ruling order in crushing social justice movements. They back thoroughly Homeland Security and all of these other institutions of control, Big Brotherism, maintenance, etc., etc. They do this nationally and internationally. The IMF, World Bank, Structural Adjustment are all programs that are based in subsidizing social justice movements on an international level. They both, Democrats, Republicans, have been in the forefront of creating death squad institutions that have planetary consequences on an international level, and they've both been involved in developing and backing institutional internal programs like the counterintelligence program and other things that have had a devastating impact on social justice movements. So to hear this charlatan defecate out this bit about Hillary saying she doesn't see a social justice movement out there or movement out there that she can kind of stand behind, when we know how deeply engaged the Democrats and Republican Party is are in crushing these types of movement, this shows you how cynical this individual is. Now, he also talked about how we're going to, you know, take back our country from the religious right. See, this is just a mystic throwing smoke. This is not just quote unquote taking back the. What does that mean? Take back the country and give it to who? And he's acting like. My point is he's acting like as if before it was taken away from the quote unquote religious right, it was more or less sustainable. This society, as it's been constructed and privatized, has never been sustainable. It's been on a destruction course. And when we know that it's based in part in a corporate state formation, to not address these aspects, is this, well, it's to be expected. Now, the aspect of him also talking about how if these things are taken from the religious right without addressing how religions themselves have played into, regardless of if you call them right, but this the institutions have played into how they grow. These religions grow by their expansion, not only over people, but over territory, which is how and why you've always seen, since the birth of these particular Abraham religions, conflicts over land, resources, etc. Because their growth of their religion is in part a real estate acquisition. So, when you don't hear him address these types of aspects, you really are hearing someone who's just playing games and wants you to be in a childlike state. Now, what's also interesting is he talks about how, the Black Caucus is going to be part of this thing that, you know, he's involved with in organizing this whole spiritual type of thing. Now, recently there was an article in the Black Commentator by Glenn Ford and Peter Gamble called Katrina Shock, Therapy for Black America. I'm going to go into a little bit of this because it goes into some of this aspects about the Black Caucus. It goes like this. The national black infrastructure has failed utterly to respond to the Katrina crisis, the wiping out of a majority black city. The Congressional Black Caucus, which claims to be the conscience of the Congress, quote unquote, has shown itself to be the appendage of the White House leadership. They slavishly followed Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi's command to make the Democratic Party look good as opposed to the Republicans, rather than directly address the crisis that was affecting their own people. 41 of the 42 black members of Congress obeyed Pelosi's edict that the House Committee on Katrina be boycotted. They accepted the order that Democrat legislators would not attend the meeting of the Katrina Committee because it was stacked against the Democratic Party. Of course, every committee of Congress is stacked against the minority, Democratic Party. That's the way Congress works. All committees of Congress are controlled by the majority party. But Democrats go to committee meetings every day, faced with a Republican majority. Nancy Pelosi, however, was able to convince the Congressional Black Caucus as a body to stand down in the face of a horrific crisis, the displacement of hundreds of thousands of residents of New Orleans. The Congressional Black Caucus failed to step up to the plate, to act as legislators that folks voted them into office to be. Only Georgia Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney broke the Pelosi and vote boycott. She attended every session and made good use of the experience, challenging the administration's witnesses every step of the way. The rest of the Black Caucus abstained from the hearing except for an occasional appearance by New Orleans Black Rep. William Jefferson, who was a representative of the affected region, was given a pass by Pelosi. Collectively, the CBC, Congressional Black Caucus, advocated any semblance of leadership. They failed to make use of the forum in which the New Orleans debacle was being discussed. Why? Because they collectively had nothing to say. And as a body, they deferred to the minority leader, Nancy Pelosi, who had decided that Katrina was not something that the Black Caucus should bother their minds about. She ordered them to boycott the Katrina hearings. And CBC Chairman Mel Watt obliged her. Only Cynthia McKinney did her job on our behalf. So this is not a commentary about minutia of legislation that has been introduced under the signatures of various Black Congress people. None of it is going anywhere anyway. It's about Black leadership and its failings in the wake of the Katrina crisis. Black congressional leadership has been dragged around by the nose of Nancy Pelosi and the rest of the white folks who are indebted to corporations. They showed their true colors on the Iraq War, when only Cynthia McKinney, out of the whole Black Caucus, voted for Murtha's bill that called for an immediate exit. The Congressional Black Caucus left Cynthia out to dry on that one, too. She was the only CBC member to vote for the bill. We have a dysfunctional Black Caucus. It cannot cope with the biggest crisis that has befallen our people ever. A whole Black city wiped off the face of the map. Yet the CBC allows itself to be manipulated into towing the party line, a white line, based on the logic of a bunch of white consultants who are in search of some mythical white American heartland. That's not where we live. White folks live somewhere else. In their world, it is the Democratic Party's interest to find middling ground, which we don't live on. So they speak to the middling ground who only exist in their minds. What we must do is address our own concerns and not be confused by the verbiage that it has nothing to do with us. It is clear that our congresspersons have drunk too much of that wine. They are drunk on somebody else's power, but it is not ours. It is in times of crisis that people show what they really have and are actually about. Nobody but our congressional representatives can make billions or dollars move. That's their job. The only reason that we bother to put them in the office, but instead they posture and primp and don't go to hearings where they should be making our case, speaking our position. Obviously, we need new leadership. That Cynthia McKinney should be so isolated does not reflect badly on her. It shows the true nature of what we have accepted as Black leadership class. They cannot fix their mouths to say that they are against the Iraq War, and they cannot bring themselves to make any case on our behalf, even when a whole city, New Orleans, was taken away from us. If the CBC cannot rise to that occasion, it's worthless. Well, it is worthless. And this whole leadership type of thing is a false construct outlined by these people who believe in the system and all this, you know, hierarchical construct as it fits within this system and stuff. But this is who Lerner is aligning himself, quote unquote, with Ness. As we can see, it's just another game that is being played out, as we should expect from those who basically are propagandist spokesmen and hocus pocus dope peddlers who speak on the left hand side of the empire. Hold on a sec. Now, to show you another side of this minstrel game that's being played out, it's kind of an appendage of what we just heard from Michael Lerner. Travis Smiley had one of his, what seems like an annual Negro festivals, ministers, hucksters, and many other types and stuff. But we're going to deal with this real quick on this Shameless File edition called The Elephant in the Room. Because no matter what these Negroes talk, there's a couple of elephants that are in their face and that are in the room. So first, let's hear Sharpton at this Travis Smiley event, sponsored, well, probably it's corporate sponsored, but Travis Smiley hosted it. So let's check this out.
We're sitting here 40 years after the Voting Rights Act, 41 years. People died, let the others die in the driveway, give us the right to vote. Four little girls died, give us the right to vote. Fannie Lou Hamer, others suffered to give us the right to vote. And we're sitting here in Houston, Texas, where they're killing more people with the death penalty than any state in the Union. Katrina victims, where you have rampant unemployment, where we don't get contracts, and somebody got to beg us to vote, nobody bombing your house, no dogs biting you, nobody arresting you, just too lazy and ungrateful to get up and go to vote.
All right, what's kind of cynical about what Sharpton is doing is that he plays into righteous grievances that many black folks have. So you hear them clapping about that. But then he does the normal fallback on the poorest section of black people who aren't voting, who, by the way, really don't attend these types of things. And so you have this little, like, class element where they keep pushing a button where instead of addressing the obvious contradictions that exist within this society, they keep being ignored intentionally for particular purposes, gains, and misdirections. You know, he talks about the four girls dying for the right to vote, Medgar Evers, so on and so forth. You know, it was a little while ago where he was at one of the funerals, and he spoke about how it's not Jim Crow we have to worry about today. It's basically James Crow Esquire. And he was right on that aspect, but that deals with what he's addressing now. When he talks about the vote, now, of course, this is all a trick because they want the masses to believe that they can vote their way into some kind of salvation. We know that's a trick bad, but now we also know, and it's been plain, that the James Crow Esquire game has electronically James Crowed black people away from being able to vote, as we've seen in the 2000 election, and as we've seen in the 2004 election, and that when Jackson and company were told to go home, when black people wanted to organize in 2000 against what was happening to them, Jackson being the obedient servant to the Democratic Party, he went the hell home. So the fact that black people have, those who believe in voting, have been electronically Jim Crowed away is one of the elephants that they don't want to address honestly, because that would take them right into the institutional framework. When it was acceptable for them to allow black people to vote at a certain stage, they temporarily granted that, you know, so on and so forth. But for their own particular advantages and conveniences, when it wasn't to their particular advantage, i.e. just, you know, who they wanted elected to a particular office, they've just excluded it. I'm not saying that voting would change anything overall. I'm just saying that it basically works down to these types of minute issues and stuff. And it was so apparent, the callousness of the Democratic Party, when one views Fahrenheit 9-1-1, when you had all of these black people who were trying, who were in the Congressional Black Caucus, who were trying to get Gore or Hillary Clinton to sign the paperwork so that they can be an investigation, and they were simply kicked to the curb. Because the Democratic Party was more concerned with maintaining the false integrity of the system than they were in protecting black people's rights. It's another elephant the room. But to expose this elephant, or to talk about the elephant that's obviously there, would expose the fact that the Democratic Party is part of the problem, which is a place where, of course, Sharpton and them don't want to go. Now, here's another Negro playing into the traitor card. Now, this is truly playing the race card. Check this out.
Taking advantage of the tools that are at our disposal. If you are eligible to vote and you don't vote, you are a traitor to your own people. A traitor to your cause. And you are denying us the ability to help transform this country for the better.
Okay, so once again, this, you know, if you aren't voting, you're a traitor to your people. If you have, you know, eligible, you're a traitor to the cause and all of that. Okay, now, of course, they're playing the game again. And it's just attacking segments of the population, especially the poor black, that are not voting and stuff. But there's another elephant in the room. New Orleans. The New Orleans elephant. Because people who played, because these Negroes basically, as we know, are talking about voting Democrat. You know, they may say just vote, but they mean Democrat because they see the Democratic Party as being the vehicle for quote-unquote social change. Yet at the same time, it was a Democratic Negro mayor in New Orleans, Nagin, that has been in the forefront of orchestrating the crushing of the black population and has been in the forefront of trying to bulldoze the black population's 9th Ward, 8th Ward residents' homes and stuff and beyond. It's a Democrat governor who's been in the front, who's played a role in the marginalization and so on and so forth, and the whole corporatization and aspect of it. But the New Orleans is the elephant, again, another elephant in the room. So here you have a situation where you have this situation going on in New Orleans. Black people are spatially deconcentrated out, and you have a situation where they're talking about voting for change. We have a society that its own little raggedy judges have said that it's okay not to allow or to set up voting booths and stuff in different locations where black people who are of New Orleans residents have been spread out, thereby depriving them of the right to participate in the vote in their own city. This is basically an orchestration intentionally by white elites who want to make a power grab as far as being servants to the ruling class themselves, to make it a more white and Republican city and stuff. So here you have a situation where not only is the elephant in the closet the New Orleans situation, but the voting thing is playing itself out in a raw racial situation. Here, this is a country where when they want people to vote, in the case of the Iraqi people, they set up voting booths all over the place in this country so that Iraqi Americans can vote for the imperialist appendages going on in Iraq. But where they didn't want black people to vote within the country that they live in, they somehow could not find the means or necessities to get those particular booths available. Just showing you the callousness of this whole situation and the elephants that exist within it. Now, there was one honest shining light within this whole Travis Smalley Civil Rights Source Awards show, and that was Harry Belafonte, who talks about the common enemy. Now, this shows you the other conflicting dynamic that black people are in when you listen to this, because listen to the audience itself, and you can see where and who black people really want to fire their energy at, and something else also. So check this out.
After the common enemy, which is capitalism in America in the hands of imperial tyrants. I've said George W. Bush is a terrorist. I did not say that to be a name caller. I did not say that to step out and, quote unquote, disrespect the office of the presidency. I said that because I see that we have not taken charge of how we define our subjugation. We are living in terrorism as black people in America. Since the dawn of slavery. If we are as oppressed as we are, if we are having the experiences we have in Katrina, if we're having the experiences we're having with our youth, with over 2 million in the prisons of America, the largest prison population in the world, if we're having problems with health care, if we're having problems with schools, if we're having problems with finding our own inner souls and dignity to live out a life that is honorable, what is it that has put us in this position? We didn't volunteer for it. And those who have put us here and have chosen to keep us here are people who deal in terror. And I think we need to not listen to how they see terror. We have to talk about how we see terror and broaden the definition. Murdering of Dr. King was an act of terror. Murdering of Malcolm X was an act of terror. Yes. Murdering of Medgar Evers was an act of terror. The murdering of Emmett Till was an act of terror. Sending young men and young women, sons and daughters from America, to murder people in other nations was an act of terror. That can heal the sick and comfort the dying and abstain from giving it generously is an act of terror. To keep our young men and women unemployed and buried in ignorance is an act of terror. So I say, let us redefine terrorism. It is not just Bin Laden sitting in Afghanistan. If it is in fact he who did what they say he did. It is how we, as African Americans, people of color, as people who are ground under, it is how we choose to name the game. It's how we choose to create the definitions about our experience that must be recognized and honored. And the only way that can be done is for us to be the ones who take charge of these facts.
Yes, absolutely.
No oppressor has ever given freedom. Those who are oppressed have been required to take it.
Alright, as you can hear, old Belafonte wasn't playing. He just made it clear. He questioned the 911 if Bin Laden did what they say he did. You know, he went into the aspect of redefining terrorism and that sending young people to other nations to fight for U.S. empire basically is an act of terror, anti-imperialism statement. And brought the aspect of the common enemy is capitalism in the hands of the imperial tyrants. And as you heard, the audience was right with them, which is why, in part, I played this, to show that many of the black people are in a contradictory mode. And when you hear Sharpton in them, because they know what the hell is devouring their lives. The New Orleans and things like that is just too raw unless you're just some kind of, you know, a right wing, you know, Armstrong William buffoon. But just for the common black person, it's too raw to not know and be faced with that type of reality. So Sharpton and them will always want to throw up the issue of us being too lazy to vote and all of this type of stuff, even though these various elephants, New Orleans, the voting scam that took place, and as Belafonte was outlining, the imperial forms of terrorism that the empire is involved in are elephants in the room that these other Sambos can't escape from. And won't escape from. Because in the end, like Hannibal, we're just going to have to jump on those elephants and stomp these crusading tap dancers into the ground. Hold on a sec. Go into a few notes from a Draptomania right quick and deal with you know, this issue of the sectarian violence that is starting to really be ramped up in Iraq right now. Right quick, let me play a little excerpt from Fox Sunday, which had this little silly panel on it, you know, and let's hear them respond to the Sunni mosque being blown up. And let's deal with it from a slave perspective. So check this out.
Bill, how serious is the situation there, and are we really going down the road toward civil war?
It's serious, but it's a serious war. And Zarqawi, presumably, Al-Qaeda, presumably, blew up this sacred shrine of the Shias, this mosque, knowing that it would cause sectarian violence. It has caused some. It has not caused a full-scale civil war or anything like it. It hasn't even caused a full-scale ethnic cleansing, and I think we can prevent that. And we should not sort of say, oh, gee, Iraqis are having problems getting along with each other. This was an attack by the terrorists designed to foment civil war, and the right answer is to redouble the war against the terrorists, not to stand back and say, ooh, those Iraqis seem to have problems working things out. They've lived together pretty peacefully, actually. They can blow up this. Sunnis and Shia have respected each other's mosques for an awful long time in Iraq. Zarqawi is trying to destroy Iraq, and we need to crush Zarqawi.
So what are you saying, Bill? That we should put that more troops?
Yes.
More troops?
Yes.
More American troops?
Blowing up the shrine. I would have liked the president to go on TV and said the next day, you know what? we're going to send it just as a precaution, an extra 15,000 troops back to the number we had during the elections, to really go after these guys and make sure they can't take the offensive and destroy the country, that we can go out and stay on the offensive against
maybe,
the terrorists.
Maybe you would have also had the president say, and we'll stay longer there than we've stayed in Korea or Germany. We'll just stay there forever, and it'll become the 51st state. I just think that's politically non-sale. Just, you can't market it, won't work, and I don't think the president's going to do it. So the question then becomes, if we don't put in more troops and don't promise to stay for all time, what do we do? And I think you have to acknowledge the country this week is on the verge of civil war, and that the terrorist element and the tensions that attend the trying to create a government have not been able to resist the pulls and tensions that come from tribalism, that come from the sectarian strife that we know, and the militias that are built into the police force and the army are supporting this sectarian violence. And the U.S. has to wise up and say, we're going to manage this in such a way as not to allow the Shiites there to become so dominant that they crush the Sunnis, or in revenge politics, or somehow, you know, join arms with the Shiites in Iran.
Well, I mean, what about that argument? Because you do hear it in the streets in Iraq that far from what's all joined together, the feeling is every group needs its own militia for protection.
Well, they do to some degree. You should not exaggerate the degree of killing in the Civil War. It's terrible what's happening, but there were 30,000 killings in France after the liberation by partisans killing those whom they regarded as collaborationists, and many other countries in the world have ethnic tensions and low-level violence. What is causing the trouble here is the terrorists. But there would not be a civil war if Zarqawi had not spent the last 2.5 years at Escobar with him, very skillfully, going on the offensive, slaughtering Shia and Karbala.
But I mean, they're there. There are going to be more mosques for them to blow up, so what do you do about the terrorists?
Kill them.
Well, we've been trying, but defeat them. Well, we've been trying, and our soldiers are doing terrifically, but we have not had a serious 3-year effort to fight a war in Iraq, as opposed to lay the preconditions for getting out.
I think that really begs the question, then, what have we been doing over there for 3+ years?
All right. The aspect of what's going on, I'm about to do this real quick, but we're going to be following this whole thing, so, you know, as it plays out. But one of the things that I wanted to address concerning this is that, of course, it could be a situation where sectarianism is this kind of getting out of control or political power struggles that are taking place. But it also could easily be a U.S. covert type of operation. But on a certain level, it shouldn't matter, because whatever is taking place, whether it is just sectarianism on a pure quote-unquote level or some U.S. type of involved thing, the occupiers are the problem. They cause the trouble. So whatever sectarian violence takes place, like say a situation that happens in an inner city or whatever, it should always be taken out on the state apparatus, the police or whatever, because they are fundamentally the problem causers. What I'm saying is that the people who are the occupiers should be the ones who pay the particular price because of if you don't address them and deal with them, they will benefit. They'll always be the ones who are going to benefit off of sectarian violence. So whether they were directly involved or indirectly, take it to them. In other words, go after the U.S. military, go after the various power structures, you know, big oil, so on, those institutions, because they're the ones who are going to benefit off of the chaos and devastation that the Iraqi people are facing. So by attacking them, that's the way you weaken the U.S. imperial forces over there and anything that's interconnected, you know, the little state apparatuses, government that's trying to align the police forces, and yes, if there's covert operators, you know, working within them who are trying to create diversion, you would weaken those bonds too. So from the way slaves should go about any of these types of situations, even though, like, amongst, it could be adaptable to the Bloods and Crips. A killing happens in a Crip-based neighborhood. It should be taken out against the force, the structural force within that society. And it's not a Blood or someone from some other set. It's the institutional powers that are part of the containment apparatus on Sam's plantation. The U.S. Empire is escalating war worldwide and internally, and it must be a situation where we take it back, take aim back at those institutions internally, at all aspects. Now, for some who are very sectarian through religion or whatever, they really can't, or it's hard for them to do it, to think in those particular terms. But I'm just saying things from down the road, when things start to really heat up on Sam's plantation, and they'll use various tricks, parlor-like tricks, like they used against the Panthers, where they would work with groups like the United Slaves, and then have the United Slaves kill Panther members like Priest Bunche Carter in L.A., and then have the Panthers go back and forth with the United Slaves. Who did that benefit? It benefited the state. So the United Slaves, they attack the Panthers. Panthers should attack that state covert operating apparatus, the counterintelligence apparatus, regardless if you had the facts on the ground or not, because you know that that's who's going to benefit from your own overall destruction. I'm not saying you don't have defense guards from those types of attacks, but your ultimate thrust should be at the state apparatus or the occupying apparatus, because they are, in essence, the crucial aspect of the operating power, with all the, which is where all these parasites of death work out of. Hold on a sec. Hold on a sec. The ravages that are this system. Sisters and brothers, do not pour your alcohol out into those streets. Save it. Pour our enemy's blood out into the streets. Pour the homicidal dogs with a pen, mayor's blood out into those streets. These same streets he's trying to sweep you from. Pour the pig butcher's blood out into the streets. Blood that's full of cowardice and hatred. The same garbage that sodomized you in his porkhouse bathroom. That hung you the other day in a Mississippi jail cell. That pistol whipped and framed you in Oakland. That took 10% of your cousins away in Texas and then bragged about it in his clan, to his clan friend at the good old boy picnic in Tennessee. Pour out the blood of the banker, the same blood they use to redline so that they can flatline our communities. Pour out the blood of the educator, the one whose job and goal is to educate us to eradicate ourselves out of existence. Pour out the blood of the other kind of educator who tells us that if we believe in their brand of invisible man in the sky, like a hypnotized drone, then we're one bloody step ahead of the non-believing slaves. for I am bored with these hocus-pocus magicians who chant and bicker the same old wretched tune, my God's better than your God. Sell your press kit books elsewhere, fools. For I am weary of hearing our mother's tears hit the streets. It's time we hear our enemy's mother's tears hit the streets. Let the Zionist Hebrew soldiers' mothers of Israel's tears hit the streets. Let the Zionist Islamic government and militia mothers of Sudan's tears hit the streets. Let it mix with the blood of the apartheid Zionist sons and daughters. Let the cowboy blood of the American soldier dry out in the sun-baked soil of Iraq. Let us drain out the blood of the capitalists worldwide. Let us drain the conductors of Halliburton's blood by slitting his throat and hanging them up to bleed like a dead chicken in Chinatown. Let us chop off the heads of the Union carbiders and have their blood flow into the streets the way they allowed their cloud of death to flow into the streets and villages of India. So save your alcohol, sisters and brothers. Use it to sterilize your wounds caused by our enemy's bullets and taser guns. Use it to splash into his eyes to temporarily blind him so you can get off your fatal shot. A shot that will have our enemy's blood pour where it belongs, into these streets. And I mean that. Until the next time, slave out.